Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. The Iran deal signed by President Obama will come before Congress shortly, probably in the month of September. And there is a lot of talk back and forth about the deal. When I first heard about the deal a few weeks ago, I came on air and I told you that I was undecided about it. I really couldn't tell. I mean, it all depended on the details. Well, I've gone through the deal now, and I've gone through the details, and I gotta be honest with you, it troubles me. A lot about that deal that I'm uncomfortable with. I'm uncomfortable about the fact that it takes so long to check to see if there are violations of the deal. I'm uncomfortable with the fact that we are doing nothing to stop Iran in its conventional support of terrorism. Iran and its proxy, the Syrian dictator, have now murdered 300,000 people. And presumably, Iran's dictator in Syria will kill another 100,000 more next year. Frankly, compared to Iran, ISIS is a piker. ISIS has killed a few thousand people. So Iran is still a very, very dangerous country. And to be fair, I'm not talking, of course, about the Iranian people. I'm talking about the Iranian government that the people itself tried to overthrow back in 2009. We can go on and on. I will go on and on about the imperfections of the deal. I do think President Obama could have gotten a better deal. And yet, anytime you're faced as a policymaker with any choices, you have to ask the question, and it's the question President Obama has asked, what is the alternative? What happens if we turn down this deal? What happens if Congress votes no? Now understand that the way this whole thing was set up, President Obama set it up so that he would have a very, very good chance that Congress is going to sustain his deal. He set it up so that Congress would have to vote no to kill the deal, and then he could veto the resolution, and then unless two-thirds of both houses of Congress sustain the veto, the deal would go through. So Obama doesn't need much. He doesn't need a majority of both houses of Congress. He doesn't need a majority of one house of Congress. He doesn't even need a third of both houses of Congress. He needs one-third of one house to oppose the deal. Most likely the deal will go through, just based on the sheer politics of it all. And yet, should it? Should it go through? And more importantly, what will happen if the deal does not go through? One idea, one option, the one proposed by the deal's strenuous opponents, is that we'll just negotiate a better deal. That the sanctions that have been tearing apart the Iran economy will make Iran come to the table. We'll negotiate a better deal, a tougher deal, a deal with more more easy verifiability, where the United States can go in and check, not just other nations, where we can go in immediately, have surprise inspections, not require several weeks, where Iran is able to hide the materials, whatever they're doing. A better deal. A deal that says that Iran will never get nuclear weapons, for example. Is that even possible? Or is the most likely consequence of no deal that our allies or even our frenemies, or enemies like Russia, frenemy like China, just say, you know what? We give up. The U.S. isn't going to negotiate a deal. We're going to give up on the sanctions. We're going to trade with Iran. We want Iran's oil. And the sanctions regime will die, and there'll be nothing done to stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, which it's really only about 2 months away from doing. And all the good parts of the deal that really does seem to stop Iran from being a nuclear power for at least 10 years, goes away, and we get the worst of both deals. So while I agree that criticism of the president is in order, because I think he could have gotten a much better deal, because I think he wanted this deal more badly than the Iranians, and I don't think he needed to, because at the last minute they threw in sanctions about conventional weapons, which had no peace in this deal, and Obama agreed to it. We can condemn all we want the process by which this deal was made. But without the deal, would the world be a safer place? I mean, we can all agree on the goal. The goal is not to have an extremely dangerous dictatorial regime to get nuclear weapons. That is the goal. But is that goal better achieved with an imperfect deal or with no deal at all? My way to resolve this, and I've thought about this at length because I ran for Congress last year. I could very well be sitting in Congress now. It could very well be my decision as to whether or not to accept this deal. And given that, well, all the Republicans are implacably against it, it's largely going to come to the Democrats to decide whether this deal happens or not. And let me be clear. The Republicans against it, the vast majority of them haven't read the deal. They're against it for the same reason they're against everything President Obama does. Right? When Mitt Romney proposes the Affordable Care Act, they support it. When Obama does the same thing, they're against it. When John McCain proposes immigration reform, they're for it. When Obama does the same thing, they're against it. Cap and Trade, Heritage Foundation proposal to help reduce pollution using economic standards. Republicans love it until Obama likes it, then they hate it. I get that. But just because Republicans will, the vast majority of them, oppose anything President Obama does reflexively, without thinking, doesn't mean that on this one they're not right. It's still the obligation of Democrats who care about whether the deal or not is a good deal to decide whether or not to support it. And some prominent Democrats, Chuck Schumer, who's going to be the majority leader after Harry Reid retires, he's opposed it. Bob Menendez of New Jersey has opposed it. Hillary Clinton supports it. And I have a lot of respect for Hillary Clinton. I also have a lot of respect for Chuck Schumer. So it's a tough thing, and it's detailed, and it deals with nuclear questions that all of us, unless we're nuclear engineers, it's probably beyond our capability. To help understand it, I've invited a guest on. We're going to hear after the break. His name is Philip Coyle. He's a senior advisor at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Now, he formerly was associate director for National Security International Affairs at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. So I don't know whether that means he has to be loyal to the president or not. He was Assistant Secretary of Defense for Test and Evaluation in the Pentagon during the Clinton years. He should at least have the technical knowledge to answer some of these questions. I will be back with Philip Coyle right after this.
Schooling the GOP, one hand tied behind his back, the Constitution in the other. It's Mark Levin. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275. Back to the Aggressive Progressive, Mark Levin.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levin, reporting live from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. We're discussing the arms deal with Iran that should stop Iran, at least in the short term, from becoming a nuclear power. But does it give away too much? Is the verification good enough? What is the alternative to the deal? To help answer these questions, I've invited Philip Coyle, a senior advisor at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Mr. Coyle was an associate director for National Security and International Affairs in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. He was Assistant Secretary of Defense for Test and Evaluation in the Pentagon during the Clinton years, and he's the author of The Challenges of Nuclear Nonproliferation, which you can find on Amazon.com. If anyone should know the technical details of what works and doesn't work in this deal, it should be Philip Coyle. Mr. Coyle, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Good to be with you.
So let's go right at some of the... first of all, you support the deal, right? Is that fair?
I do support it, yes.
Okay. So let's go through some of the criticisms about the deal. Probably the biggest criticism I've heard, although there are several, is that if Iran cheats on the deal, it will take us 24 days to find out, that American officials won't even be able to find out, and by that time they can hide what they've done. Is that a fair critique?
Well, no, it's not quite correct. Iran, we have 24/7 access. We, meaning the inspectors, the International Association of Atomic Energy Inspectors, have 24/7 access to all of Iran's declared nuclear sites. That means a reactor that they have, the centrifuges that they have, mining facilities, all of these sites that are declared. The number of days that you described applies only to sites that we might discover later that Iran has never said they had. So sure enough, if our intelligence specialists detect that Iran is doing something else at some other site that we never knew about and that Iran never declared, then indeed there is a process you have to go through in order to get access to that site, and that process can take as much as 24 days. But that does not apply to the sites we already know about.
And that process requires that there be a vote of eight nations, the so-called P5 plus one, the United States, Britain, France, Germany, Russia, China, Iran, and then the EU. And that way, I guess if the EU votes with the Western alliance, then by a 5-3 vote, we could get in there. But if the EU doesn't, or one of those, Germany or someone doesn't, then we can't. Why was it set up that way? As a way that it really has to be we have to be very, very sure Iran's cheating before we can go in at this new site.
Well, it's set up that way because really no sovereign nation will agree to let anybody go anywhere they want, no matter what without any reason for it, at any time. For example, we, the United States, wouldn't let, let's say, Russia inspect any old place that they wanted to inspect just because they felt like it, and nor would they, Russia, allow us to inspect any old site that we wanted to inspect, even though we never really could say why. And so it would take that many days to work through such questions, but the fact that Iran has agreed to it is really significant because, as I say, no other sovereign nation has ever agreed to anything like this before.
What capability do we have to detect cheating?
Well, we have a lot of capability, especially since what we're talking about are radioactive materials, which have long half-lives and which are easily detected by various kinds of radiation detectors. One of the most important parts of this deal is the access by the IAEA, by the International Atomic Energy Association inspectors. And those inspectors have a very important role to play, and they have a pretty good record around the world, and so their role will be really important. And the deal includes the IAEA inspectors checking, for example, their mines and mills for 25 years. And checking their they're monitoring their production, assembly, and storage of centrifuges for 20 years. So the deal goes longer than some people have understood. Some people keep talking about 10 years. It's only good for 10 years.
Dennis Ross, who is, of course, Bill Clinton's Mideast negotiator and certainly no Republican stooge. He's a, I think you'd agree, he's a very fair man. And he doesn't oppose the deal. But he raises some concerns about the deal. He mentions that year 15 that Iran will be able to build a large industrial nuclear program. Is he wrong about that?
Yes, he is, because the IAEA will be monitoring other aspects of the Iranian program for 20 and 25 years.
So what? There's several different time frames here, and it is very confusing and technical, but that's indeed why I brought you on here, to explain the technical stuff to us. There's like something after 8 years, 10 years, 15 years. What are the years, and what do they prohibit?
Well, you're right. It is confusing. First of all, Iran is agreeing that for 10 years. They will not exceed the enrichment limits that are agreed to under the plan, under the deal.
That's 10 years.
Yes.
Okay.
And that for 15 years, they will not enrich any uranium above 3.67%. So that's for 15 years.
So wait, what's the difference? So I got, what's between the 10 years and the 15 years? What can they do after 10 years that they can't do? What can they do between years 10 and 15?
They can begin to enrich uranium for nuclear power purposes, not for weapons, but for nuclear power purposes.
So they can't do any enrichment then for the next 10 years. Is that right?
I'm sorry?
They can't do any enrichment for the next 10 years, and they can go up to 3.67% between years 10 and 15?
They can use their oldest and crummiest centrifuges. They're allowed under the deal to use their least efficient centrifuges for enrichment, but only those centrifuges for the first 10 years.
To what extent is this a question of knowledge? In other words, there's capacity in uranium. You have to have the raw materials. You have to have the centrifuges and so forth. But in playing with nuclear power, scientists can learn basically what works, what doesn't work, how to make centrifuges more effective. One of the criticisms of the deal, and we're probably going to have to take a break, and I'll have to get your response after the break, but one of the criticisms of the deal is that even if they're not allowed to build now, they can still play with it. They still have their enrichment infrastructure. They don't have to give it all up. They don't have to destroy it all. And that they can basically learn how to make things better so that come year 10, 15, 20, maybe 25, then they can go forward and build a nuclear weapon. And I'd like to address that when we come back. Folks, if you want to call in, it's 888-48-MARK, 888-488-6275. My view is the deal is imperfect, but probably better than the alternative, which is no deal. But I want to hear from you if you want to call in. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back right after this.
And now, the voice of reason in an unreasonable world, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. My guest is Philip Coyle. He's a senior advisor at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, former associate director for the White House, former assistant secretary of defense during the Clinton years, and the author of The Challenges of Nuclear Nonproliferation. We're talking about the Iran deal. If you want to call in, it's 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. So, Philip, the question I asked before the break is, given that even if Iran stops proliferation, that it still will have the ability to sort of refine and its technical capabilities, why wouldn't that mean that it would be ready to go when some of these deadlines expire?
Well, what Iran can do eventually as we've been discussing it, the time frames vary about various different things. But after some period of time, like 15 years or so, Iran could build up its nuclear power program for nuclear electricity. But it still would not be able to enrich uranium to 90%, which is what you need for nuclear weapons. So Iran would be able to go to higher percentages than 3%, 3.5%, but not to 90%, which is what you need for nuclear weapons.
And we would find this out through satellites or other techniques that find radioactivity.
Yes, and through the inspectors on the ground, the IAEA inspectors.
Now, I remember when North Korea deal was done, the IAEA had cameras actually in their main nuclear facility and monitored everything. This was the deal signed by Bill Clinton. And for several years, North Korea did absolutely nothing and didn't develop nuclear weapons. And then one year, frankly, the year that we were involved in Afghanistan and Iraq, so we were kind of busy focused elsewhere, North Korea simply turned the cameras off and proceeded within, I guess, a year or so, to develop a nuclear weapon. Why couldn't Iran simply brazenly violate the deal just like North Korea did?
They could. They could cheat or they could just brazenly violate the deal. They certainly could do that. And the moment they did it, we would know. And then we would have to deal with that as a separate matter. But Iran would have violated, what's become a very public agreement. And I believe that the international community would come down very hard on Iran.
And, why didn't we come down harder on North Korea? Why didn't we come down harder on North Korea 10 or 15 years ago when they broke the
deal? I think we did everything with North Korea that we could. North Korea never cooperated to the extent that Iran has in this deal. Iran is agreeing to things that North Korea never agreed to, which is why I think this deal is important.
Some of the things that Dennis Ross mentions, and I think it's a really well-written article. It's in the Washington Post, called "Iran Deal Leaves United States with Tough Questions." And to be clear, Dennis Ross does not oppose the deal. He, in addition to being Bill Clinton's main Middle East negotiator, was a special assistant to President Obama from 2009 to 2011. So this is not some unthinking critic of the deal. But what he says is that there are things that President Obama could unilaterally do to make the deal stronger. In other words, doesn't have to scuttle the deal. But he could say, number one, that we will never let Iran become a nuclear power. He could repeat that. He said it in the past. But he could repeat that and make it clear that when some of these deadlines expire, that's still the administration policy. That costs nothing to make that statement, but might reassure some critics and might bind U.S. policy to some future years. I'll get to the other two in a minute, but what do you think about that idea?
Yeah, I agree the president could do that more, but he's been so plain about that, I think it goes without saying.
Okay, the second thing that Dennis Ross talks about is basically that Iran, totally apart from nuclear weapons, is a sponsor of terrorism. It's not just it's on the terrorist watch list. It frankly supports the Assad regime in Syria, which has killed hundreds of thousands of innocent people. It supports Hezbollah. It supports a lot of the militias in Iraq. It's doing bad things, and that the $100 billion, $150 billion, however much we release when sanctions are removed, may very well help them fund not just their economy, which we have no problem with, but some of these terrorist groups. And basically he said that he thinks Obama should stand firm and say that just because we have this deal doesn't mean we can't reimpose sanctions or do other things if Iran steps up its terrorist funding. What do you think about that?
Well, yes, and I believe the president made that point himself. Was it yesterday on NPR when he was interviewed by Steve Inskeep? And pointed out that we will have other sanctions regimes to deal with things like Iranian missiles and other things that Iran does.
So this doesn't end all sanctions. We could still impose sanctions on Iran for its conventional mischief in the region. Is that right?
Exactly, but we should, but we can worry less about Iranian missiles if they don't have nuclear warheads on them than if they do.
That certainly makes sense. Let me go to some of the callers. Oh, just wait, first, the third thing that he points out is that he fears that every single challenge justification, he doesn't mention the 24-day rule that I mentioned, but basically that everything will become, he writes, quote, will every challenge be turned into a negotiation, unquote. In other words, every single time we think they've done something, that it will turn into a negotiation. And Ross's view is that we have to make clear and do so at the outset that even relatively small violations will be responded to forcibly by the administration, because he fears that they will sort of try small ones, and if they're allowed to do them, they become medium ones and then perhaps large violations. What's your view about sort of enforcing the deal strictly?
I agree with that. I think Iran will probably test various aspects of this deal once it's put into place. And the United States and the other partners are going to have to be very firm about the implementation of the deal. We're going to have to follow through on all the implementation details.
Ross writes, quote, spelling out consequences that cannot be blocked even for the smallest transgressions will be important in this regard, unquote. Well, I'm very satisfied with what you have to say. I would like to see the president say all these things loud and clear. Maybe you think he already has, that one, even in the future, Iran won't be a nuclear state. Two, we will still respond to conventional violations. And three, even the smallest transgressions, we're going to watch carefully. I think if he were to say that, he would win over a lot of skeptical Democrats like myself who want to support a deal, but really want to know that this will be as tight as it possibly can be. So if you have any influence with the president, maybe encourage him to make those statements. That would make me feel a lot better about the deal.
Well, from what I hear, he's already saying those things.
Good. Good. I hope he continues to. Let me go to some of the callers. They're all over the map on this, and I want them to be able to ask you questions and have you respond to them. But we're going to take your calls pretty quickly, folks, because there are a lot of you, and I want to give Phil Coyle a chance to respond. Mike from Memphis on line one, go ahead.
Hey, Mark, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you, sir?
I just want to know, why is it so hard for the opposition to believe in the nuclear science? I mean,
you mean Republicans who oppose it?
What they have to be lying about what the deal is, you know, inquired.
Well, I think the answer is that there's some nuclear scientists who very much support the deal. In fact, there's a letter in the New York Times of 29 very eminent nuclear scientists who support the deal. But then there's an alternative. I'll just read to you. This is from the op-ed page of today's Washington Post by David Albright, who's a very well-respected, I believe he used to be, was he chair of the IAEA at one point, Phil Coyle? He was.
No, but he's worked with them for many years.
Yeah, I mean, he's certainly a very well-respected voice. And he's saying, for example, that Iran is covering up what they've done at Parchin. And his view is that if they won't come clean on what they've done in the past, they can't be trusted to do what they've come clean in the future. I guess the answer, and I'll give Phil a chance to respond, but my answer is that the deal as it's written would be a really good deal if they abide by it, but there's concern that the Iranians are well, at least David Albright's concerned, is that they're already cheating. But I want to give Phil Coyle a chance to respond.
Well, yes, indeed. They can cheat, and I think we'll all stipulate that. But part of the deal is that Iran is to come clean about their past activities in their negotiations with the IAEA.
Do you think, so David Albright's article, did you have a chance to read that, his op-ed this morning?
Yes.
Okay, what do you think about his criticism about the Parchin, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, military site near Tehran, and his view that Iran hasn't come clean on that? Do you agree with him?
Well, yes, but you could cite other examples, the things that Iran has done For example, our intelligence people discovered a secret site that's called Fordo that was built underground, and we hadn't known about it from the outset, but we discovered it. It's a different example of Iran trying to do something that they got caught at.
So you believe that David Albright's criticism is valid, but you think Iran will, with this criticism, eventually comply and show us what it's done?
Yes, I think what's important here also is that these long time periods of 10 and 15 and 25 years are going to be many, many years where we will be working with Iran, we will be dealing with them, the IAEA will be dealing with them, and we'll learn a lot over those years about how serious Iran is for peace.
Okay, fair enough. Let's go to Andy on line two. Andy is in Lincoln, Nebraska. He opposes the deal. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Thanks for taking my call, Mark. How are you?
I'm good. So briefly tell us why you oppose the deal, please.
Well, they get over 20 days, and there's so much that they could hide within that, because as it shows often, history repeats itself, and I'm very scared that it's going to repeat itself again with, like, because the Nazis didn't just openly show they were building all these military weapons and everything. It was very, very secret.
Okay, thank you, Andy, for your call. I appreciate it. Let me rephrase this to Phil. So Andy raises what I raised at the beginning, the 24-day limit. You point out that that's only for new sites that we don't know about. But he's concerned, look, Iran, as you just admitted, Fordo was hiding their nuclear weapons. He brings up the Nazis, hid some of their buildup. He fears that Iran's going to put one over on us, and we won't be able to find out in time.
Well, I think you have to ask, what's the alternative? What if we didn't have a deal? And then what happens is Iran builds more and more centrifuges, enriches their uranium to weapons grade, and by some estimates, they could do that. They could do that to produce their first nuclear weapon in as little as 2 to 3 months after the deal fell through. So the question is, why would you want Iran to have nuclear weapons? That's the alternative, and... So, yes, Iran may cheat. We'll find out about that, thanks to the inspectors and our own intelligence community. But the alternative is Iran's going to get nuclear weapons, and I don't think that's good for us or Israel or anybody in the region.
I think we all agree that nobody wants that. The disagreement is over how best to achieve that. And you make a good argument. If not the deal, then what? Opponents say we'll get a better deal. Proponents say this is the best deal that we can possibly get. And if Congress turns it down, many of our allies will lift sanctions and Iran will go forward anyway. Let me go to Kim in New Mexico on line three. Kim supports the deal. Tell us why, Kim.
Hi, Mark. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I support it very much, though, because as Secretary Kerry indicated, if we don't agree to this deal, then year 20 starts tomorrow. You know, exactly. What is the alternative? But I wanted to ask, is there as much dissension in other countries that are involved in this as there seem to be in ours?
That's a great question, and I don't know the answer. Phil, France, UK, Germany, obviously Russia and China populations don't really have a chance to express their views. But our Western allies, at one point in the negotiations, I remember a few months ago, it seemed that France was taking a tougher stand than we were against Iran. How do our allies feel about this deal?
Yes, our allies support it. The people in those countries, in France and Great Britain and so forth, support it. And so, of course, do their governments. And as you say, at various points in the negotiations, those countries were very tough themselves.
Are the populations, are we the only country where, you know, our Democratic body, our Congress, might reject the deal? Is it safe to say that the British Parliament and the French and German parliaments are pretty strongly supportive? That we're the most difficult country, as it were, of the West?
Yes, I'm not aware of any move in France or Great Britain, you know, to have a vote the way we're about to do here next September. That's happening here in the United States, but I'm not aware of it happening anyplace else.
Okay, we got to take another break, folks. If you want to call in, here's your chance to ask questions of a real expert on this. Toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. I'll be right back with Phil Coyle right after this.
Rumor has it he quotes the Constitution in his sleep. Is it super nerd? No, it's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275.
Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. My guest is Phil Coyle. Mr. Coyle is the senior advisor for at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. He's a former White House official, and he's the author of The Challenges of Nuclear Nonproliferation. Phil, I've really enjoyed the way that you've explained a lot of this. I think you've been very frank and honest about the possibility of Iran cheating, but also the view that there really isn't an alternative. And you've given a lot of detail. Maybe I am super nerd, but I do appreciate all the details in what is, after all, an extremely complex agreement. I have to say, though, while I'm impressed with the 29 nuclear scientists who support the deal and things like that, I've been less than impressed with President Obama's defense of the deal. It seems like he has personalized it. He's called critics of the deal the same people who supported the Iraq War. For the record, I oppose the Iraq War, but I still have some concerns about this deal. He even at one point compared opponents of the deal to Iranian hardliners. It seems to me that his rhetoric by sort of ad hominem attacks against those who oppose the deal is not as effective as scientists and people like yourself who patiently walk us through the details of the deal. And I just wanted to share that critique with you.
Well, it seems to me that the president is trying to express how important this deal could be, not only to America's future, but also to Israel's future. Iran is a threat to Israel today without nuclear weapons, but they would certainly be a much worse threat if they had nuclear weapons.
Well, I think we all agree that most of us agree that we don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons, and the question is not the goal, but the strategy of getting there. President Obama has said that if Iran cheats, there will be snapback sanctions. Once we've given $150 billion or so, released that money, that frankly, it's money that we've frozen, how do sanctions snap back?
Indeed, that's the agreement. Under the deal, that the sanctions will snap back, and that means that all the parties to the deal would reimpose them. So that would mean that the European Community, Great Britain, France, and so forth, all of the parties to the deal would reimpose their sanctions. Now you can say, well, are we really sure that would happen? You know, might not there be somebody who would say they didn't want that to happen in some one of those countries, and would that make a difference? But they have agreed that they will reimpose their sanctions.
Okay, and I appreciate, again, you're coming on the show and sharing with me your views. My own views are I'm inclined at this point to support the deal, but partly I have to say I'm concerned that President Obama wouldn't punish the smallest violation. I'm concerned that he believes that doing so would bring his legacy to a close. And yet the deal's going to last 8, 10, 15, 25 years. It may well be a future president, maybe a future president like Hillary Clinton, or maybe even a Republican, who might be stronger on the deal. And that means that the deal itself, the enforcement of the deal, really will be out of Obama's hands in 15 months. And that's another reason why, on a very close decision, I would support the deal. But I do want President Obama to come and do the things that Dennis Ross asked him to do very openly. Phil Coyle says he's already done so. I'd like to hear a very clear statement on those three things. That would make me feel a lot better. Philip Coyle, thank you very much for coming here and joining us on The Inside Scoop. As I said, Philip Coyle is the author of The Challenges of Nuclear Nonproliferation, which you can find at Amazon.com. And I very much appreciate his expertise on the show. If you want to comment, go to MarkLevineTalk.com. Post your comments there. You can also comment on Twitter at MarkLevineTalk. This is Mark Levine, signing off.